forget you. Pug said, I never forgot you either, Thomas. When you unravel this mystery on Sorcerer's Isle, I trust you will send word? Pug said he would. They embraced, saying goodbye, and Thomas walked away, but stopped and looked back, a boyish glint in his eyes. Still, I would love to be there when you meet Carlene again, with a wife and son in tow. Pug flushed, for he viewed that coming reunion with mixed feelings. He waved to Thomas as he walked from sight, then found Katala regarding him with a determined look upon her face. In even, measured tone, she said, Who is Carlene? Liam looked up as Arutha entered the command tent. The younger brother said, I thought you would have retired by now. You're exhausted. I wanted some time to think, Arutha. I have had little time alone and wanted to put things in order. His voice was tired and troubled. Arutha sat next to his brother. What sort of things? This war, father, you, I? He thought of Martin. Other things? Arutha, I don't know if I can be king. Arutha raised his eyebrows a little. It is not as if you had a choice, Liam. You will be king, so make the best of it. I could refuse the crown in favour of my brother, said Liam slowly, as Erland renounced it in favour of Roderick. And what a fine kettle of soup that became. Should you want a civil war, that would be one way to get it. The kingdom cannot afford a debate in the Congress of Lords. There are still too many wounds to be healed between East and West, and De Bas Tyra is still at large. Liam sighed. You would make a better king, Arutha. Arutha laughed. Me? I am little pleased at the prospect of being Prince of Krondor. Look, Liam, when we were boys, I envied you the affection you gained so quickly. People always preferred you to me. As I grew older, I understood it wasn't that I was disliked. It was simply there was something about you that brings out trust and love in people. That is a good quality for a king to possess. I never envied the fact you would follow father as duke, nor do I now envy your crown. I once thought I might take some time after the war to travel, but now that will not be possible, for I must rule Krondor. So do not wish this additional burden of the entire kingdom upon me. I would not take it. Still, you would make a better king. Liam caught Arutha's gaze and held it. Arutha paused, frowned, then fixed his brother with a skeptical look. Perhaps, but you are to be king, and I expect you will remain king for quite some time. He stretched as he rose. I am for bed. It has been a long and hard day. Nearing the entrance to the tent, he said, Ease your doubts, Liam. You will be a good ruler. With Caldric to advise you, and the others, Colgan, Tully, and Pug, you will lead us through this time of rebuilding. Liam said, Arutha, before you go. Arutha waited as Liam made a decision. I wish you to go with Colgan and Pug to Sorcerer's Isle. You've been there once before, and I'd like your judgment on what is found there. Arutha was displeased and started to object. Liam cut him off. I know you wish to go to Krondor, but it will take only a few days. There will be 12 days between the time we reach Rillanon and the coronation, ample time for you to join us. Arutha again began to object, then with a wry smile acceded. Trust in yourself, Liam. If I won't take the crown, you're left with it. As he departed the tent, he added with a laugh, There's no other brother to claim it. Liam sat alone, absently sipping at his wine. With another long sigh, he said to himself, "There is one other, Arutha, and may the gods help me decide what is right to do." Chapter 15. Legacy. The ship dropped anchor. The crew secured the sails aloft while the landing party made ready. Meacham watched the preparation of the longboat. The magicians were anxious to reach the castle of Macross, for they had more questions than the others. Arutha was also curious after resigning himself to the voyage. He found he also had little desire to take part in the long funeral procession that had left from Ylith the day they sailed. He had buried his grief for his father deep inside, and would deal with it in his own time. Laurie had stayed with Kasumi to aid the assimilation of the Serrani soldiers into the Lamushan garrison, and would meet them later in Rillanon. Liam and his nobles had shipped for Krondor, escorting the bodies of Boric and Roderick. They would be joined by Anita and Carleen. Then all would convey the dead in a procession of state to Rillanon, where they would be laid to rest in the tomb of their ancestors. After the traditional period of 12 days mourning, Liam would be crowned king. By then, all who would attend the coronation would have gathered in Rillanon. Pug and Colgan's business should be completed in ample time for them to reach the capital. The boat was readied, and Arutha, Pug, and Colgan joined Meacham. The longboat was lowered, and six guards bent their backs to the oars. The sailors had been greatly relieved that they were not required to accompany the landing party, for in spite of the magician's reassurances, they had no desire to set foot upon Sorcerer's Isle. The boat was beached, and the passengers stepped out. Arutha looked about. "There seems to have been no change here since we last came." Colgan stretched, for the ship's quarters had been cramped, and he enjoyed the sensation of dry land under his feet again. "I would have been surprised to find it otherwise. Macross was one to keep his house in order, I wager." Arutha turned and said, "You six will stay here. If you hear our call, come quickly." The prince started toward the path up the hill, and the others fell in without comment. They reached the place where the path forked, and Arutha said, "We come as guests. I thought it best not to appear invaders." Colgan said nothing, being occupied with observing the castle they were approaching. The strange blue light that had been so visible when they had last visited the island was absent from the window of the high tower. The castle had the look of a place deserted, without movement or sound. The drawbridge was down, and the portcullis raised. Meacham observed,
"At least we won't have to storm the place."
When they reached the edge of the drawbridge, they halted. The castle rose above them, its high walls and taller towers, forbidding. It was built of dark stone, unfamiliar to them. Around the great arch over the bridge, strange carvings of alien creatures regarded them with fixed gazes. Horned and winged beasts sat perched atop ledges, seemingly frozen in an instant, so cleverly were they fashioned. They stepped on the bridge and crossed the deep ravine that separated the castle from the rest of the island. Meacham looked down, seeing the rock walls of the crevice fall away to the level of the sea, where waves crash through the passage between.
"It serves better than most moats I've seen. You'd think twice before trying to cross this while someone was shooting at you from the walls."
They entered the court and looked about, as if expecting to see someone appear at one of the many doors in the walls at any moment. Nowhere was there sign of any living creature, yet the grounds about the central keep were well tended and in order. When no one was forthcoming, Pug said, "I imagine we'll find what we're after in the keep." The others moved with him toward the broad stairs that led to the main doors. As they mounted the steps, the large doors began to swing open, until they could all see a figure standing in the darkness beyond. As the doors finished their movement with a loud thump against the keep walls, the figure stepped forward into the sunlight. Meacham's sword was in his hand without thinking, for the creature before them bore a strong resemblance to a goblin. After a brief examination, Meacham put up his weapon. The creature had made no threatening gesture, but simply stood waiting for them at the top of the stairs. It was taller than the average goblin, being nearly Meacham's height. Thick ridges dominated its forehead, and a large nose was the focus of its face, but it was nobler in features than a goblin. Two black twinkling eyes regarded them as they resumed their climb. As they came up to it, the creature gave a toothy grin. Its head was covered with a thick mat of black hair, and its skin was tinged with the faint green of the goblin tribe, but it lacked the hunched, shouldered posture of a goblin, instead standing erect, much like a man. It wore a finely fashioned tunic and trousers, both bright green. Upon its feet were a pair of polished black boots, reaching nearly to its knees. The creature said, grinning,
"Welcome, masters, welcome. I am Garthus, and I had the honor of acting as your host in my master's absence."
There was a slight hiss to its speech. Colgan said, "Your master is Macross the Black?"
"Of course. It has been ever thus. Please enter."
The four men accompanied Garthus into the large entry hall and stopped to look about. Except for the absence of people and of the usual heraldic banners, this hall looked much like the one in Castle Crydee.
"My master has left explicit instructions for your visit, as much as was possible to anticipate, so I have prepared the castle for your arrival. Would you care for some refreshments? There is food and wine ready."
Colgan shook his head. He was unsure of what this creature was, but he was not overly comfortable with anything that so resembled a servant of the Dark Brotherhood.
"Macross said there would be a message. I would see it at once."
Garthus bowed slightly.
"As you will. Please, come with me."
He led them along a series of corridors to a flight of stairs that spiraled up into the large tower. They mounted the steps and soon came to a locked door.
"My master said you would be able to open this door. Should you fail, you are imposters, and I am to deal with you harshly."
Meacham gripped his sword at hearing this, but Pug placed his hand on the big Franklin's arm. "Since the rift is closed, half my power is lost, that which I gained from Kellawan, but this should prove no obstacle." Pug concentrated upon opening the door. Instead of the usual response of the door swinging open, a change occurred in the door itself. The wood seemed to become fluid, flowing and ebbing as it fashioned its surface into a new form. In a few moments, a face could be seen, formed in the wood. It looked like a bas-relief, with a slight resemblance to Macross. It was very lifelike in detail, and appeared to be asleep. Then its eyelids opened, and they could see that the eyes were alive, black centers showing against white. Its mouth moved, and a voice issued from it, the sound deep and resonant, as it spoke in perfect Surani.
"What is the first duty?"
Without thinking, Pug answered, "To serve the Empire." The face flowed back into the door, and when there was no trace of it before them, the door swung aside. They entered and found themselves in the study of Macross the Black, a large room occupying the entire top of the tower. Garthus said,
"I take it I have the honor of hosting Masters Colgan, Pug, and Meacham?"
He then studied the fourth member of the party.
"And you must be Prince Arutha?"
When they nodded, he said,
"My master was unsure if your highness would attend, though he thought it likely. He was certain the other three gentlemen would be here."
He indicated the room with a sweep of his hand.
"All that you see is at your disposal. If you will excuse me, I will return with your message and some refreshments."
Garthus left, and all four looked at the contents of the room. Except for one bare wall where it was obvious that a bookcase or cupboard had recently been removed, the entire room was surrounded with tall shelves from floor to ceiling, all heavily laden with books and scrolls. Pug and Colgan were almost paralyzed by indecision about where to begin their investigation. Arutha solved that problem by crossing over to a shelf where lay a large parchment bound with a red ribbon. He took it down and laid it upon the round table in the center of the room. A shaft of sunlight from the room's single large window fell across the parchment as he unrolled it. Colgan came over to see what he had found.
"It is a map of Midkemia."
Pug and Meacham crossed over to stand behind Colgan and Arutha.
"Such a map," Prince Arutha exclaimed. "I have never seen its like."
His finger stabbed at a spot upon a large landmass in the center.
"Look, here is the kingdom."
Across a small portion of the map were inscribed the words, "Kingdom of the Isles." Below could be seen the larger borders of the Empire of Great Kesh. To the south of the Empire, the states of the Keshian Confederacy were clearly shown.
"To the best of my knowledge," said Colgan, "few from the kingdom have ever ventured into the Confederacy. Our only knowledge of its members is through the Empire and a few of our more venturesome captains who visited some of their ports. We hardly know the names of these nations, and nothing about them."
Pug said,
"We learn much about our world in an instant. Look at how small a part of this continent the kingdom is."
He pointed to the great sweep of the Northlands to the north of the kingdom, and the far-reaching mass of land below the Confederacy. The entire continent bore the inscription, "Tri-Asia." Colgan said,
"It appears there is a great deal more to our Midkemia than we had dreamed."
He indicated additional landmasses across the sea. These were labeled Winyet and Novindus. Upon each, cities and states were delineated. Two large chains of islands were also shown, many with cities marked. Colgan shook his head.
"There have been rumors of traders from far distant lands venturing into the trading ports in the Keshian Confederacy, or treating with the pirates of Sunset Islands, but they are only rumors. It is small wonder we have never heard of these places. It would be a brave captain who set his ship upon a course for so far a port."
They were brought out of their study by the sound of Garthus returning to the room. He carried a tray with a decanter and four wine cups.
"My master bade me say that you are to enjoy the hospitality of his home as long as you desire."
He placed the tray on the table and poured wine into the cups. He then removed a scroll from within his tunic and handed it to Colgan.
"He bade me give you this. I will retire while you consider my master's message. Should you need me, simply speak my name, and I will return quickly."
He bowed slightly and left the room. Colgan regarded the scroll. It was sealed with black wax, impressed with the letter M. He broke the seal and unrolled the parchment. He started to read to himself, then said,
"Let us sit."
Pug rolled up the large map and put it away, then returned to the table where the others were sitting. He pulled out a chair and waited with Meacham and Arutha while Colgan read. Colgan shook his head slowly.
"Listen," he said,
and read aloud.
To the magicians, Colgan and Pug, greetings. I have anticipated some of your questions and have endeavoured to answer them as best I can. I fear there are others that must go begging, as much about myself must remain known only to me. I am not what the Surani would call a great one, though I have visited that world, as Pug knows, upon a number of occasions. My magic is peculiar to myself and defies description in your terms of greater and lesser paths. Suffice it to say, I am a walker of many paths. I see myself as a servant of the gods, though that may be only my vanity speaking. Whatever the truth is, I have travelled to many lands and worked for many causes. Of my early life I will say little. I am not of this world, having been born in a land distant both in space and time. It is not unlike this world, but there are ample reasons to count it strange by your standards. I am older than I care to remember, old even by the elves' reckoning. For reasons I do not understand, I have lived for ages, though my own people are as mortal as yours. It may be that when I entered into the magic arts, I unwittingly gave this near immortality to myself, or it may be the gift, or curse, of the gods. Since becoming a sorcerer, I have been fated to know my own future, as others know their pasts. I have never retreated from what I knew to be before me, though often I wished to. I have served great kings and simple peasants both. I have lived in the greatest cities and the rudest huts. Often I have understood the meaning of my participation, sometimes not, but always I have followed the foreordained path that was set for me. Colgan stopped for a moment. This explains how he knew so much. He resumed his reading. Of all my labours, my role in the Rift War was the hardest. Never have I experienced such desire to turn from the path before me. Never have I been responsible for the loss of so many lives, and I mourn for them more than you can know. But even as you consider my treachery, consider my situation. I was unable to close the rift without Pug's aid. It was fated for the war to continue while he learned his craft on Kellywan. For the terrible price paid, consider the gain. There now is one upon Midkemia who practices the greater art, which was lost in the coming of man during the Chaos Wars. The benefit will be judged only by history, but I think it a valuable one. As to my closing the rift once peace was at hand, I can only say it was vital. The Surani Great Ones had forgotten that rifts are subject to the enemy's detection. Colgan looked up in surprise. Enemy? Pug, this refers to something I think you need explain. Pug told them quickly of what he knew of the legendary enemy. Arutha said, Can such a terrible being really exist? His expression betrayed disbelief. Pug said, That it once existed, there is no doubt, and for a being of such power still to endure is not beyond imagining. But of all conceivable reasons for Macross's actions, this is the last I would have thought possible. No one in the assembly had dreamed of it. It's incredible. Colgan resumed reading. It is to him like a beacon, drawing that terrible entity across space and time. It might have been years more before he would have appeared, but once here, all the powers of your world would be hard-pressed, perhaps even insufficient, to dislodge him from Midkemia. The rift
had to be closed. The reasons I chose to ensure its closing at the cost of so many lives should be apparent to you.
Pug interrupted.
What does he mean, should be apparent?
Kogan said, Macris was nothing, it seems, if not a student of human nature. Could he alone have convinced the king and emperor to close the rift with so much to be gained by keeping it open? Perhaps, perhaps not. But in any event, there would have been the all-too-human temptation to keep it open just a little longer. I think he knew that and was ensuring there would be no choice.
Colgan returned to reading the scroll.
As to what will happen now, I cannot say. My seeing of the future ends with the explosion of the rift. Whether it is finally my appointed hour, or simply the beginning of some new era of my existence, I do not know. In the event you have witnessed my death, I have decided upon the following course. All my research, with some exceptions, is contained within this room. It is to be used to further the greater and lesser arts. It is my wish that you take possession of the books, scrolls, and tomes contained here and use them to that end. A new epoch of magic is beginning in the kingdom, and it is my wish for others to benefit from my works. In your hands I leave this new age. It is signed Macross.
Kogan placed the scroll upon the table. Pug said, One of the last things he said to me was he wished to be remembered kindly. They said nothing for a time. Then Colgan called,
Garthus!
Within seconds, the creature appeared at the doorway.
Yes, Master Colgan.
Do you know what is contained within this scroll?
Yes, Master Colgan. My master was most explicit in his instructions. He made sure that we were aware of his requirements.
We?
Said Arutha.
Garthus smiled his toothy grin.
I am but one of my master's servants. The others are instructed to keep from your sight, for it was feared their presence might cause you some discomfort. My master lacked most of the human prejudices and was content to judge each creature he met on its own merits.
What exactly are you? Asked Pug.
I am of a race akin to the goblins, as the elves are to the Dark Brotherhood. We were an old race, and perished but for a few, long before humans came to the Bitter Sea. Those that were left were brought here by Macross, and I am the last.
Kogan regarded the creature. In spite of his appearance, there was something about him that was likable.
What will you do now?
I will wait here for my master's return, keeping his home in order.
You expect him to return? Asked Pug.
Most likely. In a day, or a year, or a century. It does not matter. Things will be ready for him should he return.
What if he has perished? Asked Arutha.
In that event, I shall grow old and die waiting. But I think not. I have served the Black One for a very long time. Between us is an understanding. If he were dead, I think I would know. He is merely absent. Even if he is dead, he may return. Time is not to my master as it is to other men. I am content to wait.
Pug thought about this. He must truly have been the master of all magic. Garthus's smile broadened.
He would laugh to hear that, Master. He was always complaining of there being so much to learn, and so little time to learn it. And that from a man who had lived years beyond numbering.
Colgan said, as he rose from his chair,
We will have to fetch men to carry all these things back to the ship.
Garthus said,
Worry not, master. Retire to your ship when you are ready. Leave two boats on the beach at the cove. At first light the next day, you will find everything placed aboard, packed for shipment.
Kogan nodded.
Very well, then we should start at once to catalogue all these works, before we move them.
Garthus went over to a shelf and returned with a rolled parchment.
In anticipation of your needs, master, I have prepared such a listing of all the works here.
Kogan unrolled the parchment and began reading the inventory of works. His eyes widened.
Listen, he said excitedly. There's a copy of Vitalis's Expectations of Matter Transformation here.
His eyes grew bigger still.
And Spandrick's Temporal Research. That work was thought lost 100 years ago.
He looked at the others, wonder upon his face.
And hundreds of volumes with Macross's name on them. This is a treasure beyond measure.
Garthus said,
I am pleased that you find it so, master.
Kogan started to ask for those volumes to be brought to him, but Arutha said,
Wait, Kogan. Once you begin, we'll have to tie you up to get you out of here. Let us return to the ship and wait for all this to be brought. We must be off soon.
Kogan looked like a child whose sweets had been taken from him. Arutha, Pug, and Meacham all chuckled at the stout magician. Pug said,
There is no good reason to stay. We shall have years to study these after the coronation. Look around, Kogan. Do you mean to inhale all this in one breath?
A look of resignation crossed Kogan's face.
Very well.
Pug surveyed all in the room.
Think of it, an academy for the study of magic, with Macross's library at the heart.
Colgan's eyes grew luminous.
I had all but forgotten the Duke's bequest, a place to learn. No longer will an apprentice learn from this master or that, but from many. With this legacy and your own teachings, Pug, we have a wonderful start.
Arutha said, Let us be on our way if we're to have any sort of start. There's a new king to crown, and the longer you tarry, the more likely you'll lose yourself in here.
Kogan looked as if his good name was impugned. Well, I will take a few things to study while on the ship, if you have no objections.
Arutha raised a placating hand.
Whatever you wish, he said with a rueful smile. But please, no more than we can reasonably lug down to the boat.
Kogan smiled, his mood lightening.
Agreed.
He turned to Garthus.
Would you fetch those two volumes I mentioned?
Garthus held out the two volumes, old and well read. Kogan looked surprised, while Garthus said,
I thought you might reach such an understanding and remove them from the shelves while you discuss the matter.
Kogan walked toward the door, shaking his head slowly as he regarded the two books he held. The others followed, and Garthus closed the door behind them. The goblin-like creature guided them to the courtyard and bid them a safe journey at the door of the keep. When the large doors had closed behind them, Meacham said,
This fellow Macross seems to have raised 5 questions for each he answered.
Kogan said,
You have that right, old friend. Perhaps we will gain additional knowledge from his notes and other works. Perhaps not. And maybe that's the right of it.
Chapter 16. Renaissance. Rillanon was in a festive mood. Everywhere banners rippled in the breeze, and garlands of summer flowers replaced the black bunting that had marked the period of mourning for the late king and his cousin Boric. Now they would be crowning a new king, and the people rejoiced. The people of Rillanon knew little of Liam, but he was fair to view and generous with his smile in public. To the populace, It was as if the sun had come out from behind the dark clouds that had been Roderick's reign. Few among the people were aware of the many royal guards who circulated throughout the city, always alert for signs of Guy de Basse-Tyra's agents and possible assassins. And fewer still noticed the plainly dressed men who were always near when groups gathered to speak of the new king, listening to what was said. Arutha cantered his horse toward the palace, leaving Pug, Meacham, and Colgan behind. He cursed the fate that had delayed them nearly a week, becalmed less than 3 days from Krondor, then the slowness of their journey to Salador. It was mid-morning, and already the priests of Ishap were bearing the king's new crown through the city. In less than 3 hours they would appear before the throne, and Liam would take the crown. Arutha reached the palace, and shouts from the guards echoed across the vast courtyard.
Prince Arutha arrives!
Arutha gave his mount to a page and hurried up the steps to the palace. As he reached the entranceway, Anita came running in his direction, a radiant smile on her face.
Oh! She cried. It is so good to see you!
He smiled back at her and said, It is good to see you also. I must get ready for the ceremony. Where is Liam?
He has secreted himself in the royal tomb. He left word you were to come straight away to him there.
Her voice was troubled.
There is something strange taking place here, but no one seems to know what it is. Only Martin Longbow has seen Liam since supper last night, and when I saw Martin, he had the strangest look upon his face.
Arutha laughed.
Martin is always full of strange looks. Come, let us go to Liam.
She refused to let him ignore the warning.
No, you go alone. That is what Liam ordered. Besides, I must dress for the ceremony. But, Arutha, there is something very queer in the wind.
Arutha's manner turned more reflective. Anita was a good judge of such things.
Very well. I'll have to wait for my things to be brought from the ship anyway.
I will see Liam, then when this mystery is cleared up, join you at the ceremony.
Good.
Where is Carleen?
Fussing over this and that. I'll tell her you've arrived.
She kissed his cheek and hurried off. Arutha hadn't been to the vault of his ancestors since he was a boy, the first time he had come to Rilinon for Roderick's coronation. He asked a page to lead him there, and the boy guided him through a maze of corridors. The palace had been through many transformations over the ages, new wings being added on, new constructions over those destroyed by fire, earthquake, or war. But in the center of the vast edifice, the ancient first keep remained. The only clue they were entering the ancient halls was the sudden appearance of dark stone walls, worn smooth by time. Two guards stood watch by a door over which was carved a bas-relief crest of the Condoin kings, a crowned lion holding a sword in its claws. The page said, Prince Arutha, and the guards opened the door. Arutha stepped through into a small anteroom with a long flight of stairs leading down. He followed the stairs past rows of brightly burning torches that stained the stones of the walls with black soot. The stairs ended, and Arutha stood before a large, high-arched doorway. On both sides loomed heroic statues of ancient Condoin kings. To the right, with features dulled with age, stood the statue of Danis, first Condoin king of Rilinon, some 750 years past. To the left stood the statue of Delong, the only king called the Great, the king who first brought the banner of Rilinon to the mainland with the conquest of Basse-Tyra, 250 years after Danis. Arutha passed between his ancestors' likenesses and entered the burial vault. He walked between the ancient forebears of his line, entombed in the walls and upon great catafalques. Kings and queens, princes and princesses, scoundrels and rogues, saints and scholars lined his way. At the far end of the huge chamber, he found Liam sitting next to the catafalque, that supported his father's stone coffin. A likeness of Boric had been carved in the coffin's surface, and it looked as if the late Duke of Cridy lay sleeping. Arutha approached slowly, for Liam seemed deep in thought. Liam looked up and said, "I feared you might come late." "As did I. We had wretched weather and slow progress, but we are all here. Now, what is this strange business? Anita told me you've been here all night, and there is some mystery. What is it?"
"I have given great thought to this matter, Arutha. The whole of the kingdom will know within a few hours' time, but I wanted you to see what I have done and hear what I must say before any others."
"Anita said Martin was here with you this morning. What is this, Liam?" Liam stepped away from his father's catafalque and pointed. Inscribed upon the stones of the burial place were the words, "Here lies Boric, 3rd Duke of Cridy, husband of Catherine, father of Martin, Liam, Arutha, and Carleen." Arutha's lips moved, but no words came forth. He shook his head, then said,
"What madness is this?"
Liam came between Arutha and the likeness of their father.
"No madness, Arutha. Father acknowledged Martin on his deathbed. He is our brother. He is the eldest."
Arutha's face became contorted with rage.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
His voice was tormented.
"What right had you to hide this from me?"
Liam raised his own voice.
"All who knew were sworn to secrecy. I could not risk anyone knowing until the peace was made. There was too much to lose."
Arutha shoved past his brother, looking in disbelief at the inscription.
"It all makes an evil sense. Martin's exclusion from the choosing. The way father always kept an eye on his whereabouts. His freedom to come and go as he pleased."
Bitterness rang in Arutha's words.
"But why now? Why did father acknowledge Martin after so many years of denial?"
Liam tried to comfort Arutha. "I've pieced together what I could from Colgan and Tully. Besides them, no one knew, not even Fannin. Father was a guest of Brocall's when he was in his first year of office, after grandfather's death. He tumbled a pretty serving girl and conceived Martin. It was 5 years before father knew of him. Father had come to court, met mother and married. When he learned of Martin, he had already been abandoned by his mother to the monks of Silban's Abbey. Father chose to let Martin remain in their care. When I was born, father began to feel remorse over having a son unknown to him, and when I was 6, Martin was ready for choosing. Father arranged to have him brought to Cridy, but he wouldn't acknowledge him for fear of shaming mother."
"Then why now?"
Liam looked at the likeness of their father.
"Who knows what passes through a man's mind in the moments before death? Perhaps more guilt, or some sense of honour. Whatever the reason, he acknowledged Martin, and Brocall bore witness."
Anger still sounded in Arutha's voice.
"Now we must deal with this madness, regardless of father's reasons for creating it."
He fixed Liam with a harsh stare.
"What did he say when you brought him down to see this?"
Liam looked away, as if pained by what he now said.
"He stood silently. Then I saw him weep. Finally he said, 'I am pleased he told you.' Arutha, he knew."
Liam gripped his brother's arm.
"All those years father thought him ignorant of his birthright, and he knew. And never once did he seek to turn that knowledge to his own gain."
Arutha's anger subsided.
"Did he say anything more?"
"Only, 'Thank you, Liam.' And then he left."
Arutha paced away for a moment, then faced Liam.
"Martin is a good man, as good a man as I've ever known. I'll be the first to say so.
But this acknowledgement! My gods! Do you know what you've done?
I'm aware of my actions.
You've placed all we've won over the last 9 years in the balance, Liam. Shall we fight ambitious Eastern lords who might rally in Martin's name? Do we end one war simply to begin an even more bitter one?
There will be no contestation. Arutha stopped his pacing. His eyes narrowed.
What do you mean? Has Martin promised to voice no claim?
No. I have decided not to oppose Martin, should he choose the crown. Arutha was speechless for a moment, in shock as he regarded Liam. For the first time he understood the terrible doubts his brother had been voicing over being king.
You don't want to be king,
he said, his tone accusatory. Liam laughed bitterly.
No sane man would. You have said as much yourself, brother. I don't know if I am a match for the burdens of kingship. But the matter is out of my hands now. If Martin speaks for himself as king, I will acknowledge his right.
His right? The royal signet passed to your hand, before most of the lords of the kingdom. You are not sick Erlen deferring to his brother's son because of ill health and by reason of no clear succession. You are the named heir.
Liam lowered his head.
The announcement of succession is invalid, Arutha. Roderick named me heir as eldest Condoyne male, which I am not. Martin is.
Arutha confronted his brother.
A pretty point of law, Liam, but one that may prove the destruction of this kingdom. Should Martin voice a claim before the Congress assembled, the priests of Ishap will break the crown, and the matter passes to the Congress of Lords for resolution. Even with Guy in hiding, there are dozens of dukes, scores of earls, and a host of barons who would willingly cut their neighbours' throats to convene such a congress. Such bargaining would end with half the estates in the kingdom switching hands in trade for votes. It would be a carnival.
If you take the crown, Bas Tyra cannot act. But if you back Martin, many will refuse to follow. A deadlocked congress is exactly what Guy wishes. I'll bet all I own he is somewhere in the city at this very moment, plotting against such an event. If the Eastern lords bolt, Guy will emerge, and many will flock to his banner.
Liam appeared overwhelmed by his brother's words.
I cannot say what will happen, Arutha, but I know I could not do other than I have done.
Arutha looked on the verge of striking Liam.
You may have inherited the burden of father's sense of family honour, but it will fall to the rest of us to deal with a killing. Heaven's mercy, Liam. What do you think will happen if some heretofore nameless huntsman sits the Condoyne throne simply because our father tumbled a pretty maid nearly 40 years ago? We shall have civil war.
Liam stood firm.
Should our positions have been reversed, would you have robbed Martin of his birthright?
Arutha's anger vanished. He looked at his brother with open amazement on his face.
Gods! You feel guilt because father denied Martin all his life, don't you?
He stepped away from Liam, as if trying to gain perspective on him. Should our positions have been reversed, I most assuredly would deny Martin his birthright.
After 37 years, what matter a few more days?
After I was king, firm on my throne, then I would make him a duke, give him an army to command, name him first advisor, whatever need be to salve my conscience. But not until the kingdom was secure. I would not wish Martin to play Boric the First to Guy's John the Pretender, and I would do whatever must be done to see that would not come to pass.
Liam sighed with deep regret. Then you and I are two different sorts of men, Arutha. I told you back at camp I thought you would make a better king than I. Perhaps you are right, but what's done is done.
Does Brokaw know of this?
Only we three.
He looked directly at Arutha.
Only our father's sons.
Arutha flushed, irritated at the remark.
Don't misunderstand me, Liam. I hold Martin in no little affection, but there are issues here much larger than any personal consideration.
He thought quietly for a moment.
Then it is in Martin's hands. If you had to do this, at least you did right in not making it a public matter. There will be shock enough should Martin come forth at the coronation. At least with advance warning we can prepare.
Arutha moved toward the stairs, then stopped and faced his brother.
What you said cuts both ways, Liam. Perhaps because you cannot deny Martin, you'll make a better king than I. But as much as I love you, I'll not let the kingdom be destroyed over the succession.
Liam seemed unable to contest with his brother any longer. Fatigue, a weary resignation toward what fate would bring, sounded in his words.
What will you do?
What must be done? I will ensure that those who are loyal to us are forewarned. If there comes a need to fight, then let us have the advantage of surprise. He paused for a moment.
I have nothing but the greatest affection for Martin, Liam. You must know that. I hunted with him as a boy, and he was in no small part responsible for my safely getting Anita away from Guy's watchdogs, a debt beyond repaying. In another time and place, I would gladly accept him as my brother. But should it come to bloodshed, Liam, I'll willingly kill him.
Arutha left the vault of his ancestors. Liam stood alone, feeling the chill of ages press in upon him.
Pug looked out the window, reminiscing. Katala came to his side, and he came out of his reverie. You look lovely, he said.
She was dressed in a brilliant gown of deep red, with golden trim at the bodice and sleeves.
The finest duchess of the court could not match your beauty.
She smiled at his flattery.
I thank you, husband.
She spun, showing off the gown.
Your Duke Coldrick is the true magician, I am thinking. How his staff could manage to find all these things and have them ready in 2 short hours is true magic.
She patted at the full skirt.
These heavy gowns will take some practice getting around in. I think I prefer the short robes of home.
She stroked the material.
Still, this is a lovely cloth, and in this cold world of yours, I can see the need.
The weather had turned cooler now that summer was waning. In less than 2 months, snow would begin falling.
Wait until winter, Katala, if you think it's cold now.
William came running into the room from the bedroom that adjoined their own.
Mama, Papa!
He yelled in boyish exuberance. He was dressed in a tunic and trousers befitting a little noble, of fine material and workmanship. He leaped into his father's outstretched arms.
Where are you going?
He asked with a wide-eyed look. Pug said, We go to see Liam made king, William. While we are gone, you mind the nurse, and don't tease Fantas. He said he would and wouldn't, respectively, but his impish grin put his credibility in doubt. The maid who was to act as William's nurse entered and took the boy in tow, leading him back into his own room. Pug and Katala left the suite Coldrick had given them and walked toward the throne room. As they turned a corner, they saw Lorry leaving his room, with Kasumi standing nervously to one side. Lorry brightened upon seeing them and said,
Ah, there you are. I was hoping we'd see you two before all the ceremonies had begun.
Kasumi bowed to Pug, though the magician now wore a fashionable russet-colored tunic and trousers in place of his black robe.
Great one, he said.
That is a thing of the past here, Kasumi. Please call me Pug.
You two look so handsome in your new clothes and uniform, said Katala.
Lorry wore bright clothing in the latest fashion, a yellow tunic with a sleeveless overjacket of green, and tight-fitting black trousers tucked into high boots. Kasumi wore the uniform of a night captain of the Lamutian garrison, deep green tunic and trousers, and the grey wolf's head tabard of Lamut. The minstrel smiled at her. In all the excitement of the last few months, I had forgotten I had a small fortune in gems with me. Since I cannot conspire to return them to the lord of the Shinzawe, and his son refuses to take them, I suppose they are mine by rights. I will no longer have to worry about finding a widow with an inn. Pug said, Kasumi, how goes it with your men?
Well enough, though there is still some discomfort between them and the Lamutian soldiers. It should pass in time. We had an encounter with the Brotherhood the week after we left. They can fight, but we routed them. There was much celebrating among all the men in the garrisons, both Serrani and Lamutian. It was a good beginning.
It had been more than an encounter. Word had reached Rillinen of the battle. The Dark Brothers and their goblin allies had raided into Yabon, overrunning one of the border garrisons, weakened during the war. The Serrani had turned from their march to Zun, dashed northward, and relieved the garrison. The Serrani had fought like madmen to save their former enemies from the larger goblin host, which they had driven back into the mountains north of Yabon. Lorry winked at Pug.
Having made something of heroes of themselves, our Serrani friends were given quite a welcome when they arrived here in Rillinon.
Being distant from the center of the war, the city's citizens felt little fear or hatred toward their former enemies, giving them a welcome that would have been unimaginable in the free cities, in Yabon, or along the far coast.
I think Kasumi's men were a little overcome by it all.
In truth, they were, agreed Kasumi. Such a reception on our home world would have been impossible, but here...
Still, continued Lorry, they seem to take it in stride. The men have developed a rapid appreciation for kingdom wines and ale, and they've even managed to overcome their distaste for tall women.
Kasumi looked away with an embarrassed smile on his face. Lorry said,
Our dashing knight captain was guested a week ago by one of the richer merchant families, one seeking to develop broader trade with the West. He has since been seen often in the company of a certain merchant's daughter.
Katala laughed, and Pug smiled at Kasumi's embarrassment. Pug said,
He was always a quick student.
Kasumi lowered his head, cheeks flushed, but grinning broadly.
Still, it is a hard thing learning that your countrywomen have such freedom. Now I see why you two were always so strong-willed. You must have learned from your mothers.
Lorry's attention was diverted by someone approaching. Pug noticed a look of open admiration upon the singer's face. The magician turned and was greeted by the sight of a beautiful young woman approaching with a guard escort. Pug's eyes widened as he recognized Carline. She was as lovely a woman as her girlhood had promised. She came up to them, and with a wave of her hand, dismissed the guard. She looked regal in a fine green gown with a pearl-studded tiara crowning her dark hair.
Master Magician, she said, have you no greeting for an old friend?
Pug bowed before the princess, and Kasumi and Lorry did also. Katala curtsied as she had been shown by one of the maids. Pug said,
Princess, you flatter me by remembering a simple keep boy.
Carline smiled, with a gleam in her blue eyes.
Oh, Pug, you were never a simple anything.
She looked past him to Katala.
Is this your wife?
When he nodded and introduced them, the princess kissed Katala's cheek and said,
My dear, I had heard you were lovely, but the reports my brother gave did you little justice.
Katala said,
Your Highness is gracious.
Kasumi had returned to his nervous posture, but Lorry stood unable to take his eyes from the young woman in green. Katala had to grip his arm firmly to recapture his attention.
Lorry, will you show Kasumi and me about the palace a little, before the ceremonies begin?
Lorry smiled broadly, bowed to the princess, and accompanied Kasumi and Katala down the hallway. Pug and the princess watched their retreating backs. Carleen said,
Your wife is a most perceptive woman.
Pug smiled. She is indeed remarkable. Carleen looked genuinely glad to see him.
I understand you also have a son.
William. He is a little devil, and a treasure. There was a trace of envy in Carleen's expression.
I would like to meet him.
She paused, then added,
You've been most fortunate.
Most fortunate, Highness. She took his arm and they slowly started to walk.
So formal, Pug? Or should I call you Malamba, as I have heard you are known?
He saw her smile and returned it.
I sometimes don't know, though here Pug seems more proper.
He grinned.
You seem to have learned a great deal about me.
She feigned a small pout.